Hi, Rocketeers. I'm Karen Thompson in the Coven rotation, filling in for Guy Branum, who's still taking statuary photos in England. And welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Wow, like so sonorous and singy today.
I have to have positive because it was a gloomy day, which is my favorite way to celebrate California.
Right?
Yeah.
Like it's the best.
It's the best.
We're finally in California winter now.
Yeah.
So it's 'tis the season.
Yeah, this is when I grow.
Absolutely. And we have a special guest today. We have media scholar, TV critic, and the person to whom I am wed, Sarah Kessler.
Yay!
Hi.
Sarah, what should our listeners know about you?
Well, you know, I feel like this has been a long time coming, you guys.
It really has. How has this not happened yet?
I feel that, you know, that people, you know, have heard so much about me, and I just... I can't believe that it's finally happened. They're finally getting to hear my voice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this
you're
is
finally getting being able to have
feels
a voice.
Really momentous instead of being spoken for all the time by my wife. Yes.
Of Tongson.
Of Tongson. but yes, I'm an academic who specializes in ventriloquism. I'm a cat lover, a whale enthusiast. I edit television criticism, write television criticism for Public Books, which you should check out, publicbooks.org. I am a lecturer at USC, and I tweet... Am I supposed to be saying all these things right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, you can.
Okay. I tweet at Movable Jaw, and most of it is like misandry in between sharing pieces that I've written and like whale-related content. Yeah.
Yes.
For people who don't know, what does it mean to be an expert in ventriloquism?
Okay, well, I don't do ventriloquism. Like, I'm not a practitioner, but
I don't have a dummy,
and I can't, you know,
like,
throw
y'all
my voice.
Kink is interesting.
But I do know a lot about ventriloquism because I wrote my dissertation on it when I was in graduate school. And
oh my God.
So, you know, I've witnessed a lot of ventriloquism.
I'm a graduate degree.
You know, in fact, I got a
what am I doing?
I know. In fact, I got a grant at one point to go
what?
To the world's well, it says it's the world's only museum of ventriloquism in Kentucky.
Of course it's there.
Yeah,
no offense to Kentucky.
Yeah, I received
or in northern of obviously.
Northern Kentucky, yeah, Covington, Kentucky. Yeah, so I'm a dilettante in terms of practicing ventriloquism, but I know a lot about it. I probably should have written a dissertation on something else.
Well, I
more
mean,
practical.
Right.
Some of the things it's come up several times in our many conversations on Pop Rocket here, where like there's something like about like someone speaking for someone else or
right.
The person behind the curtain, and I'm like, well, you know. My wife who works on ventriloquism. Anyway, well, she's here, everybody. You get to hear her actual voice, and I will no longer be ventriloquizing her through the Pop Rocket discourse here. But, you know,
so
guess
vindicated.
What? Speaking of relationships and power, we're going to be talking this week about the Bravo limited series Dirty John, which is based on a true crime podcast. And we're also going to be talking about other true crime objects from podcasts to its movement to the small screen. And as usual, we're going to be sharing our latest jams. But first, we're going to find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Winter.
Yes.
What is going on in Winter's world?
I woke up this morning and, you know, somebody tweeted that they're tired of hearing me talk about horror. And I was like, okay. I
oh,
get
seriously?
It. Seriously?
Remember
they said there was
that person?
Who is that
really
person?
Really nice of that person.
To
I mean,
let me know their opinion.
Yeah, thank you.
On
that.
A social media platform. So I was like, okay, what other horror can I talk about since I'm waiting for him to challenge us to not, for me not to make my all about horror. And I woke up this morning and watched the George H.W. Bush funeral, which the reason why this is my all about is because there's been a lot, sadly, of these, you know, dignitaries are leaving us, and every time I watch the funeral, I hate that I'm waiting to see what would Trump do or what's he gonna do.
Mm-hmm.
And today, I mean, they were fairly restrained because he didn't go to Barbara's, right?
No.
He wasn't invited.
Yeah.
And McCain's, he was not invited.
Definitely not invited to that.
So this was the first time that they were all there together, and I was like, okay, how's this gonna go? And watching this dynamic, it actually gave me peace that there's still some people in the world who want to be shady. And this is Hillary and Michelle. their consistent and concerted effort to be like, oh, fuck, nah. First of all, W came down and he, you know, as he arrived into the cathedral, he greeted people that had attended, but then he got to sort of the front pew and Trump and Melania were there. And then it was Barack and Michelle. And then it was Bill and Hillary. And then it was Rosalind and
Jimmy.
Rosalind and Jimmy. Sorry, that was pre my birth. So I
it's
could.
True. It's fair.
It's fair, right? I've gotten to this point now where I'm observing human behavior on such a visceral level because I'm trying to, because I want to understand this dynamic. Mm-hmm. I want to understand like every single thing because I feel like I have to watch a murderer lurking around every corner and then trying to like forensically, dissect like what happened here.
So this is your forensics of the human experience.
Yes.
Circa 2018.
2018. And I saw like how like sort of W like brusquely like shook Melania and Trump hands, and like Trump is so awkward in human interaction, he does things that don't seem comforting. I could watch a sitcom or a dramedy about this relationship between all of them for hours. But the one thing that got me that I didn't think expect to get me is, you know, I spent so many years disliking W and now I have somebody to hate more. And just when he broke down talking about HW, like, you know, one thing, again, I've said this over and over, I'm really getting tired of drag culture. And I forgot, and I think people are forgetting.
Dragging
like,
people, not dragging the people.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Race. Thank you. Love drag race.
I was just like, we need drag culture now more than ever. What are you talking about?
We do. Oh my God, that's going to be my dissertation.
This drag culture, not that.
Yeah,
drag culture.
This versus that drag. And and I just feel like I, you know, I, as much as the one thing that I knew that I would see this morning is people being like, don't forget, Bush didn't do this. Don't forget. And it's like, okay, at the end of the day, somebody's dad died. You know what I mean? His mom died earlier this year. As somebody who watched my father deal with two parents dying within a year of each other, it's really emotional. It's aggressive. It completely changes your entire constitution to know that it is now just you orphaned without the others. And I just wanted to take an opportunity to say, independent of all the things I hated that George Bush may have contributed to or did not contribute and use his power to do, I have a lot of respect for how that family has been, you know, very stand up during this culture war and do it with such class and candor is, you know, I know he's a war criminal, but I really appreciate that because it's an important thing to do.
I think that's one of the things, too.
That's the point that we've reached.
Exactly.
I know he's a war criminal,
but that is exactly where I think, you know, but we could go on ad nauseum about this, but like we found ourselves in such a state of deprivation for like dignity and human interaction from our leaders that like
and from that, and from and presidentialism.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think that's just what people seem to feel is missing. Like people are like, where's the presidentialism that allows us to overlook the criminality?
Yeah.
You know, that allows us like where's like the nice package for all the like horrible shit that like goes on.
So Sarah Kessler, what are you all about this week?
Well, I have been really into My Brilliant Friend, which is the new HBO series based on Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan tetralogy.
Oh my God.
Have either of you read the tetralogy? Trilogy except four. Four books.
Didn't even know. I
actually
learned so much tonight.
Did not know that term until someone
corrected you on Twitter.
No, until until like, you know, in the space of TV editing, someone proposed something like on the tetralogy, and I was like, oh, tetralogy, what a great word.
Yeah.
So for those who are not familiar, these books, which themselves are really, really bingeable, chart this relationship between these two really intense girls from their very young childhood through adolescence, through kind of married life, through adulthood and into late middle age. Mm-hmm. And their names are Leela and Lenu, and they're kind of coming of age in a working class, fairly impoverished neighborhood in Naples, post-war Naples.
Oh, wow.
And they have this really intense relationship that's kind of, it just feels in the books really, really true to so many of the female friendships that I've had in my life. There's so much jealousy, so much competition, mm-hmm. and kind of jockeying for position in the relationship. But there's also such a kind of shared fantasy world and such a deep love and affection that is shared by these two girls, you know, who then become women and have this incredibly complicated relationship. And so I'd known that the HBO show was coming up. And I think, like a lot of people who really, really love the novels, I sort of felt like I was waiting to pounce on what would be bad about it, you know, like how the adaptation would fail the original mm-hmm. books. And, you know, and from the first episode, like, I couldn't find anything wrong with it, but I felt sort of like meh about it because it starts with these two very young girls playing them as very young girls. But then moving into their adolescence when they're teenagers, it just becomes really engrossing. And it's very PBS circa like the 80s. And so it's like totally my wheelhouse of like the shows that I was allowed to watch
like
as a child. Well, it's like very muted tones and like a lot of piano music. Like it's like it's like the same like refrain on the piano like every other scene. And it's like you,
I know exactly.
You know exactly.
You guys were born in 1980, both of you.
You keep saying it like it was a bad thing.
No, it's a good thing.
You know,
it's a great thing.
You know exactly sort of like, you know what you're in for, and it's kind of it was before prestige television, right? It was before like what we now understand
that
as prestige television,
yeah.
And that was our prestige. And so it is really interesting to me actually that it's chosen to kind of revisit that aesthetic, you know, that sort of prestige aesthetic, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you know, and the portrayals of these characters are actually really rich, and they somehow manage to find a way to bring the depth of these to make the depth of these relationships visible mm-hmm. the further you get into it. And so I'm really liking it at this point.
Well, so let me ask you, if you haven't read the tetralogy,
the tetralogy,
would you recommend going ahead and watching the series? Do you feel that, like, you know, for anybody out there who's just like, well, should I wait to watch this till I read the books? What would you say to them?
I mean, you know, in general, I'm really, you know, I mean, as because we're married, you probably already know, like, I'm not really a purist. I don't even care about spoilers ever. Like, I don't really
Me
care.
Either.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm just not someone who's attached to like the kind of purity of any sort of piece of culture. But in this case, I do have to say, I feel like having read the books and read them over the summer, I really binged them. And I do feel like it's really enriched the experience of watching the show. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that many people who are watching it who haven't read the books, just simply because I'm an academic and like a lot of our friends have read the books. But I mean, I don't. Yeah, maybe I might, because like the books are so easy to read and they're very absorbing. I mean, they're really like, I mean, they're really, you know, it's not like deep theory. It's like feelings and you know.
Well, I mean, I think that I often like to watch something first so that if I want to flesh the world out, I have more in
back.
The books.
Yeah.
The thing that I'm interested about, I guess this is too, I don't want this to be too industry or inside baseball, but like HBO is having like a weird time figuring out its programming, and mm-hmm. I feel mm-hmm. like, you know, to go to this route, it seems very narrow. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I guess my you know, what it would be the draw in if you're not really kind of trying to watch a post-war Naples friendship through the ages,
and
why,
you know,
am I watching this?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
it's not Sex and the City.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I mean, I do feel like HBO is having a weird moment right now.
Yeah.
And I think that has a lot to do with the sort of shifting, whatever's shifting in the kind of prestige TV landscape, right?
Yeah.
They had a lock on that and they don't anymore. And also, people were like, they need to diversify their content. And they've done that in some interesting, whatever. They're sort of in a weird moment. But I do feel like, I don't feel that there's that much incentive to watch My Brilliant Friend if you haven't invested in the world already or heard a lot about it.
I feel like this is a throwing the gauntlet down around prestige. I feel like this is like, this is what this prestige is supposed to be about.
This is what it's supposed
sweeping
to look
historical
like.
Historical epic, like, you know, big surging melodramatic feelings,
piano music,
PBS circa 80s, let us reclaim our legacy. And I think that that's the move they're trying to make with this, knowing also that this is the Neapolitan series,
the Neapolitan tetralogy.
Tetralogy is so like so popular with a certain kind of middle brow, like I read the New Yorker, like crowd.
Yes,
so,
exactly.
You know, so I think that it's trying to
1987
like,
again.
I think, yeah, exactly. I think that they're trying. That's where they're throwing down the gauntlet. Yeah. Is to trying to be like, let's establish some truth here, or like you know, like some I don't know, like some.
Well,
false
let's
kind
create
of
some new like prestige text, you know, that people will then refer back to. But
I don't
I mean,
think it's
but
the,
but
work.
It, but it's not.
No,
gonna, it's,
I don't either.
It's too. It's too late for that. And yeah. and there's also something like revisiting that past form of prestige, it has a weird vibe. Right?
It's still acting like they just not. This is not a referendum on HBO and its programming. Like I'm really sorry, but like in a world we're right now in a glut of best picture movies. I just don't know what's going to get nominated for best picture this year. I'm like, is it going to be Ralph Breaks the Internet?
It's going to be Roma.
Roma, it's going to win.
It's going to be Roma.
Yeah. So like, I'm just like, what are you doing? And how do you change it? And why am I watching The Conners? I never wanted to watch that at all.
I
just don't know what's going on.
Yeah. It's confusing. It's confusing.
Yeah. Well, to bring a little lightness to the table. What I'm all about this week, actually, is we were lucky enough this weekend to have seen, I can say we because, like, my spouse is here. We saw A Pardon on Sherla, who I admired from afar on Twitter for a while, and we got to see her perform like, this wonderful live set at Josh, which is the monthly comedy event hosted by Michelle T and Tara Jepsen locally here in Los Angeles, and it rotates at different locations, usually at people's houses, which is awesome. And anyway, A Pardon on Sherla did not disappoint. Her set was amazing. If those of you who don't know her, she's actually currently voicing Hollyhock, or BoJack Horseman's long lost daughter, on the current season of BoJack Horseman. And she also has one of those 30 minute specials on Netflix in that stand up series. Her comedy in general deals very sardonically with mental illness. And in particular, depression and anxiety.
And like, if you don't have anxiety, the way I would describe it is like there's an edgy improv group in your brain. And it just needs like a one word suggestion to spin like countless scenarios that no one's comfortable with. Like the whole time you're just like, when will this show be over? I just came to be supportive. None of these thoughts have a future.
There's a kind of like a special cheerfulness behind her deadpan delivery that I just find super kind of relatable and charming. As she said on her Netflix special, I'm someone who has a lot of anxiety, and it's weird that anxiety is finally on message.
Right.
And she also had another great line. Do you remember it, Sarah?
Yeah, no, she. This was one of my favorite parts of her set. She was like, you know, I suffer from anxiety and depression, and, you know, in millennial speak, that means that, you know, sometimes my brain is extra AF, and the rest of the time it can't even. And I found that really amusing.
Yeah, but there's something about like the way it's the way she delivers this content that it's also it's a little bit like it's there, again there's a kind of slight deadpan to it.
It's very
And she does like do that kind of South Asian comedy, but not, you know, like she has a whole shtick in her stand-up show about her parents texting her. She does this kind of funny slideshow, this kind of low-tech TED Talk on her stand-up set, which is great. Like the kind of like, how come, you know, all the family emojis, you can't change the color on the family emojis, but the blonde guy, you can, but the his hair's still blonde, right? You know, and everything. But there's, anyway.
That
I know,
bothers me too.
Yeah, right? Is that weird? I know that I'm
obviously. I don't want a Cisco icon. I didn't ask for that.
Right? I know that I'm
bizarre.
Not.
Bizarre.
I'm really not selling her comedy very well with my delivery of it, but I highly recommend checking her out on
Twitter.
And her
Twitter handle is pretty funny.
It's very funny.
She also said that she had been mildly dehydrated for her entire life.
Which is so, it really is on my
And like, I really identified with
that. She's also in one of my fave films of the summer, which was A Simple Favor, directed by Paul Feig. So anyway, there's also a great Vulture feature on her. Please support this comedian and look out for them on like BoJack Horseman and on other specials coming up. And especially if you are a disaffected, depressive, anxious millennial. So before we go to break, I'd like to play a message actually left by one of our listeners who sent a question in for us on our hotline.
Which I love is, that we have a hotline.
I love that we have a hotline. This is a 530 number that's essentially we've come to determine as Guy Branum's mom's voicemail. And anyway, so this is our listener question, Allie from New York.
Hello, hello. This is Allie from New York. And like a lot of the rest of the world this week, I was really pleasantly surprised by Ariana Grande's Thank You Next music video. It just came out and it celebrated some of the best of our pop culture sort of OG rom-coms. So she chose Legally Blonde, Bring It On, 13 Going on 30, and Mean Girls. And in a world that's so different today from when those came out, it made me think about how classic favorites like those would be so different in today's world with social media, and how things have changed. Like the three-way call in Mean Girls would probably be a text thread, or Elwood would have had to stop herself from stalking the heck out of her ex to keep herself motivated, keep on going in law school. So it would be so fun to hear from you guys on how your favorite rom-com classics would be different in today's world with technology and social media coming into play. I already can't wait for Winter's perspective on this. So thanks, guys, and thank you for making my week awesome. I always look forward to you. Rock on. Thanks.
All right. Allie from New York wants to know how Winter would feel about a rom-com world that would be transformed as the digital strategist in the room. Like, if you could think of a classic rom-com and how different something would be in that interaction. If you don't have something off the top of your head, let me share one here. As
of course, I knew you'd have one. You go first,
one.
KT.
Let me share one. When Harry Met Sally,
yeah,
when they're talking on the phone late at night and watching movies together, and it's all split screen, basically any Nora Ephron film where that's happening.
Yeah.
They would be like FaceTiming or some weird shit at this point.
They'd just be texting.
Or texting. And it would lose that sort of sweet like split screen thing that Nora Ephron did so well in all of her rom-coms. I'm even thinking about You've Got Mail. Like Nora tried to trace all of those transformations in communication.
Sure.
Sadly, she didn't live to get to this point to show us how beautiful she could make that. But I do think that that would be a wonderful thing to see what Nora Ephron would do with the ways that we depict texting and communicating now.
I mean, really quickly, Heartburn, she would have found out that Mark was cheating on her way faster than she did. And it would have been in messages. It would have been like literally in like a thread. Like I saw Mark at the fucking whole thing.
Oh, God.
You know, it would have been, I think I watched Working Girl, which is my number one favorite rom-com.
So good.
And it wouldn't.
30th anniversary.
30th anniversary this year. Amazing article by Christopher Gardner and THR, who got to do like an oral history of it, which is just a dream. Tess would have not been able, you know, they make it a really short time period that she does all this. When you think about it, it took her like 10 days to sort of build this deal together, get with Harrison Ford. That whole thing was about 10 days.
Yeah.
And she would not have been able, with email and CCs and everything, she wouldn't have been able to get as far as she did. Because somebody would have been like, who is Tess?
Yeah.
And why is she at this party?
Google image search her ass.
Google image search her ass. Who is Tess? And then, like, you think about, what's the Julia Roberts one?
Pretty Woman.
No. The one with her and
Mystic Pizza's
come
not
on,
right.
guys. The okay. one where she's with where she, her my best friend's wedding.
Okay,
you think about Julia Roberts and My Best Friend's Wedding, and even that involves technology. Her sending that message again. It would have taken somebody like an email. She tried to send that email over a weekend. Somebody would have responded back immediately and been like, "What?" So,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, people, for a long time, technology was used in some of these movies as sort of like a plot point, and it was all hedging on the fact that no one was checking for their phone every 12 seconds.
Nobody had like a watch that kept pinging with noise.
Exactly. And a lot of these movies would have been over. And I think, you know, the one thing I will say is that the reason I really, 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 really love Thank You Next is because it's nice to see 25-year-olds, because Ariana Grande is 25, starting to feel nostalgic about now you know how
I
it
can't
feels.
Believe she's only 25 years old and she's just like, I've been through so much. She's like, I've learned so much.
There's so
I am
much has
all
happened.
The woman I need.
It's true. Like, although she did go through that major trauma of the Manchester concert.
Oh, hey, yeah.
Manchester, her boyfriend died. Yeah.
I mean, I think she's amazing. I love her.
I do, too.
Yeah.
But she's been through a lot. I will give her
I
this.
Didn't have half the good sense of Ariana Grande when I was 25.
I haven't had a boyfriend die. I haven't had anybody shoot up my concert. I'm giving her a little bit of credit on this. But I also think that it's kind of, I wish she hadn't done 13 on 30. That movie's not iconic. but I, you know, I would have preferred she'd done something like The Wedding Planner. But, you know, I think it was cute to see somebody.
Oh, the 13 going on 30. The one. Yeah, yeah.
You know how I feel about Jen Garner.
Well, thank you, Allie from New York, for stimulating a little extra convo. We'll be right back to talk Dirty John and true crime right after this.
Hey, it's Janet Varney of the JV Club podcast, and I am so excited to be joining Maximum Fun. If you're not yet familiar with the JV Club, it's a podcast with me and some of my favorite women, and in the summer, men, as we explore the highs and lows of our terrible teenage years into our adult lessons. For example, hear about Allison Brie's humiliating moment at a gymnastics competition, experience the shame of a knocked out tooth with Jamila Jamil, or drop in as John Hamm imagines what would happen if Bambi met Godzilla. So join me and all my once awkward, often still awkward, friends every Thursday by subscribing to the JV Club on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio,
Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh.
Sarah Kessler. Tongson. Sarah of Tongson.
Well, that's so weird. I've never heard you use my name in that way before.
You loved it just now.
You got a tingle in your loin, didn't you?
Yeah, you did.
Oh my, stop. We're here to talk serious business,
right,
folks.
Right.
We're here to talk. We're here to talk about true crime. But first and foremost, we're here to talk about a show that's made a pretty, like, splashy debut on Bravo in this kind of middling season between like the end of the November sweeps.
Yeah.
It's so perfectly timed and before all the real holiday stuff kicks in. Mm-hmm. The LA Times Wondery podcast Dirty John has leapt from your earbuds to the small screen, and it stars Eric Bana as Dirty John. And the wonderful Connie Britton.
Love. Mm-hmm.
As Deborah Newell, the mm-hmm. female lead. Sarah Kessler, could you give us a little summary of the general arc of the Dirty John plot without giving too much away?
Sure.
For listeners who might not be familiar with what all this dirty talk is about.
For listeners who may care about spoilers, unlike myself and Winter. So Deborah Newell is a successful Orange County interior designer.
Yes.
She's a self-made design. Woman. Yeah. Her company is called Madera Designs. She, you know, drives to work each day looking fabulous. Her hair is blonde.
And the right purse.
She always has a fabulous purse. And she's got a great family, very tight-knit. Her only kind of sticking point is that she's been married several times and is kind of online dating in middle age. And she meets this man, John Meehan, or Meehan. They pronounce his name differently, depending. And she is really into him, and her daughters, who are these, you know, very blonde OC girls, are just immediately repulsed by this guy, and, you know, and find him shady. And she gradually begins to kind of understand why.
Ooh.
And
so that's a pretty good tease there. That's the general premise of it is that we have someone who seems like they're, you know, we're not sure at what point the story is starting, whether, like, if those of you who watch the story and are not familiar with the podcast or not familiar with, there's a true crime story, could think, well, this could be one of those, it could veer towards the romantic. It could veer towards, like, she's finally found her Prince Charming late in life. And
but
I think
it's
that
behind the orange curtain.
It's behind
the orange curtain. That's not how it works down there.
Especially not when you're getting Dana Point condos last minute.
I mean, and it's called Dirty John.
It's true. It is called Dirty John. But I think that that's one of the things, especially that the showrunner of the TV series was kind of trying to point out, is that there's so many different elements that could go into this story and could veer in numerous directions. Could we play? We actually have a little clip from the Dirty John podcast. It's actually the bonus episodes. It's after the six main episodes where it talks about the TV series. And this is the showrunner, Alex Cunningham.
One of the things I loved about the Dirty John material was it was actually an opportunity to write a lot of the different kinds of stuff that I've written in my career. There's procedural stuff in there, law enforcement procedural stuff. There's, you know, obviously the emotional twisted fairy tale version of it, which, you know, I mean, I always, soap seems to be kind of a dirty word in our business, but I actually think any story that has emotional stakes is a soap. Like, I, Claudius is a soap. Saving Private Ryan is a soap.
It's not wrong.
Yeah, no, I mean, wrong. I love that. I think she's right on the money with that.
Yeah. Well, so Winter, you've never listened to the podcast. You're entering this true crime world through...
Oh, you're going in blind.
You're going in blind. So what are some of your impressions going into this show as someone who, you know, didn't get caught up in the whole podcastery of it early on?
You know, I'm a true crime fan, and the thing that, you know, I have to have, like, there has to be like a couple things, because I've seen every Snapped, I've seen all the most Dateline specials, seen most, you know, of all the sort of soapier things. And I've been looking at these things for a long time since there were telemovies in the 80s. And the thing that drew me into this is, one, it was just the actors. I love Connie Britton. She never, you know, her being in the People versus O.J. Simpson, really, she just killed it. So I knew she would be good off top. Mm. I think Eric Bana is fucking sexy. But I also think that hearing so much about it, for Bravo to take a chance at doing something like this, again, we just talked about HBO.
Yeah.
And sort of like, if HBO had done this, like, mm-hmm. this is where they need to be doing, FYI.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. This is the space you need to be into, because I want the juice and I want it hardcore. And I want to know every single detail. And that's sort of what I've been presented watching these last two episodes. And I love how in the second episode, they just get right in. He's creepy as fuck. He says weird shit. He does weird things. I also have to say, like, one of the things that's always missing from a Lifetime movie is that it has zero budget and they wrote it in 2 days, mostly probably while drinking vodka sodas. So it's just like kind of going everywhere with the dialogue, and the actors are always some people from Canada that, like, this is what they do. They do like one a week. I like that it's a little bit more A-list, and that they stay they sort of were able to budget-wise keep it consistent with what's actually happened. I really believe these two people in this role being these characters, and because I know that the podcast was really well regarded by people like you, who I respect, and other people, I was like, okay, as long as they stay close to this narrative and stay and kind of track what the podcast is doing, which is based off the source material, which is based off of the actual people, there, how can this be wrong? That's why I love People versus OJ. They had so much material to work with, and they used it to their advantage.
It's so like high budget that they didn't have to get Canadians. They got Australians and British people. They got like some
people.
Deep.
No, is he Australian? He's Australian.
Australian. Yeah, and like, I mean, I feel like the A-listness of the stars involved is kind of what makes its cheese.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
Like there's something about
it's aged,
you know,
cheese.
It's aged cheese.
It's a fine case.
But there's something about, like, you know, I love Connie Britton's willingness to throw herself into the role of this, you know, OC woman, quintessentially OC woman. Like, I love Bana's willingness to throw himself into the kind of cargo short wearing, you know, American trailer park living kind of weirdo that, I mean, it's just.
But who has, like, a, you know, it's the thing. It's like somebody who has, like, just the right amount of handsomeness and, like, the enough charm to get to somebody in a particular way.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, well, he looks like Eric Bana on the show, but the Dirty John, like, for those, you know,
I just looked at a picture of him and sorry, I would have been fucked up too with the whole thing. He has
I mean, he's pretty, like, he's like the real life John Meehan also was somebody who would have been like very Orange County handsome.
Right.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. You know, like particularly appealing to like someone who's dating in a middle-aged pool, you know, where these guys are often like, who look like that are often trying to date way younger.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You just freaking nailed it on the head.
He'd like, be trying to date, you know, he'd be trying to date
her daughter,
Veronica, right? Yeah. Her oldest daughter rather than her.
Which
typically.
The psychology of that, we have to like go into that because I feel like her daughter is also like, how there's a little bit of resentment there. There has to be. That has to have come
through. Well, let's back up a little bit and think about this more broadly in relationship to true crime and how many true crime stories really have women in like love stories at the center of it. Like essentially like, you know, women who are dealing with a husband who's done some dubious things or have, one of the things we noted, like when we were listening to a lot of true crime podcasts on this last road trip we took Thanksgiving to Santa Fe, it's always like some guy has always killed some woman. Right? Yeah. It's always like a man is killing women.
I mean, basically, there are like women, there are dead women whose identities we don't know, who are constantly being identified as having been killed by like intimate partners at some point.
This is like the, one
who
of
then become the like brilliant subjects of these true crime narratives.
Like Bear Brook, for example.
Or like Bear Brook. Or there are wives who are just absolutely treated terribly, or girlfriends who are absolutely treated terribly, who are clinging to the shreds of these relationships for various reasons, and who are just willing to accept more and more, right? To continue to lower and lower and lower the bar.
Well, where the violence is at first emotional violence, and then it like broaches into physical violence. I'm thinking here, and I'm going to address each of you with a couple of things that I know both of you know. One is another podcast that made a huge stir recently in
Australia.
Teachers. It's Australian. It's called Teacher's Pet.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, just I think today or yesterday, and we're recording on a Wednesday, FYI, that actually Chris Dawson, the husband, who's like, they could not pin the crime on him, has just been finally arrested. Was it like 30, 40 years later?
Wow.
Like,
or,
it was in the, I believe early it was 1982.
Yeah,
oh
yeah.
My
the crime
God.
Yeah. place. Yeah.
So like this many years later, but like the amount, like, so there's that. And we also have, the Mrs. Broderick story on
I was going to say the Mrs. The Betty Broderick story.
Yeah.
And before I was...
Which was not a podcast, but it was a TV...
Was not a podcast, but it was like, you know, Betty Broderick was a San Diego socialite, you know, lawyer, attorney's wife, and her husband. I've been obsessed with her literally since this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still trying...
Also in the 80s. All of this stuff is happening in
the
80s.
And I don't know
women
why...
Women were just being, like, killed and fucked up in the 80s.
Well, no.
And no one was doing anything about it.
The reason this is different is because she did the murdering. And this kind of goes back to what I was going to say earlier.
I like where this is going.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're going into, like, we're seeing, you know, women who actually murder, it's not something that's common, but I think the reason why I love this story so much is because, you know, she was in a situation where everything should have gone perfectly and as planned, and the deviation from that stemmed from things that women usually don't combat. She was, you know, dealing with a cheating husband, dealing with a disrespectful household, dealing with, you know, her stature as being this sort of, you know, trying to retain that.
Mm-hmm.
And it really never had anything to do with him. She never wanted him back.
This is Betty Broderick.
Betty Broderick. She never really wanted him back. She just wanted to retain what she had earned.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she was losing that because he was bullshitting with his bullshit, she was like, I'm not having that. And that story ended up going, you know, it took over Southern California fable, tale, story. And that ended up becoming like a national news story. And to me, the mini O.J. Simpson thing before the O.J. Simpson thing, because these were prominent, prestigious people in a very small, wealthy community. And this is what you aspire to. And she was ready to tear all that shit down to get what she needed. The saga ended up becoming a long, sordid affair. And then it was one of Lifetime's most successful telemovies, starring Meredith Baxter, Bernie, and called A Woman Scorned. And, you know, Betty.
Such a great title.
Such a great title.
Oh, my God. Love that expression.
But Betty had no. She really had no regrets about it. And I feel like in the 80s.
She gave zero fucks.
She literally gave zero fucks. Like, who and what and don't care. I don't have anything anymore. And during the 80s, like, there was a deliberate stranger about Ted Bundy. They did a lot of different movies in the 80s that sort of took, you know, Star 80 is one of my favorite other true crime, you know, about Dorothy Stratton. And that was played to perfection by Muriel Hemingway and Eric Roberts. I always think about the cadet murders in Texas, where the cadets gang up together to murder the cheerleader who cheated on her boyfriend with.
I mean, I think that that one of the things, too, though, is that, like, podcasts, particularly the true crime podcasts, at least the ones that seem most compelling, are come from a place of deep investigative reporting, revisiting cold cases. Again, like, and again, it becomes like the smartest ones really do have a read of what the kind of power and gender dynamics are.
Yeah, there's
are.
Some kind of interpretation.
Did you want to elaborate on this vis-a-vis, you know, Teacher's Pet and maybe a little bit about Bear Brook as well?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so, like, one of the things I think with, well, with Teacher's Pet and with Dirty John, right, and with something like Bear Brook, which we just listened to, you know, you have that kind of quintessential, like, white male sort of NPR-style guy, like, doing this investigative reportage and kind of, and giving it to you straight and in a kind of, less so for Teacher's Pet, but sort of giving you this information, right? And this is like a voice that we've been trained implicitly to trust in its verity. And so, you know, that I think is kind of like something that's problematic that runs over a lot of these podcasts, where it almost to me feels like a lot of the commentary, like, say, on gender is implicit. Mm-hmm. However, I still feel that it's there. Mm-hmm. I still feel that it's there. I feel that it's implicit in the sense that they're not saying, like, you know, this, you know, like I don't recall in Dirty John it being about, like, this is, you know, a tale of.
There was no editorializing.
There was no editorializing, but, like, in the Teacher's.
About, like, saying, you know, like, for example, this really messed up thing happened to Deborah's sister. At the hands of her husband.
And, like, let's think about how masculinity relates to
this.
Yeah,
and, like,
that
how
was
the
not...
mom is also complicit in perpetuating this story of you just have to forgive the man for whatever he does.
Exactly.
Right?
But, I mean, I think that there is a way that in these stories being brought out and in, say, the character of Deborah Newell, I don't know if she's redeemed either in the podcast or in the TV series, but there's something about centering the sort of narrative of Deborah Newell and of her daughters kind of combating and dealing with this dangerous person that does, I guess, you know, allow for a kind of read of the toxicity of masculinity, like, vis-a-vis these women who, I think, you know, I think it's understandable, like, why, as Connie Britton has said in her kind of comments about playing the role of Deborah Newell, like, it's understandable why this woman would be taken in. And she's not some stupid dupe. She's not, like, an idiot. She's, you know, an intelligent, self-made woman with a real career. But she's romantic, and she wants love. And
all of these romantic stories, including in Teacher's Pet, essentially basically tell us that, you know, Lynette Dawson is basically like, I have to keep my perfect looking family and marriage together, even if it's so deeply obvious that this shady ass dude is, like, bringing the babysitter in to live with us.
Yes.
And, like, you
or
know,
I think,
basically,
you know,
essentially, like, paving the road to replace me with this person.
And I've seen
17 Lifetime movies about that.
Yes.
By the way.
I mean, and in Dirty John also, like, you know, I've gone to such great lengths to convince my daughters this guy is okay. I've gone to such great lengths to convince all the people in my life that I've got it together and that he's a good man. And when that starts to crumble, oh shit, what am I going to do? Because I need to maintain my image in a way that a man never has to.
Yeah. Yep.
And, you know, and I need to maintain my image. I need to still continue to be strong in this situation. Yeah. In the face of, like, my disposability to this person.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, but this is something, actually, very recently, I was at a podcasting symposium, and the scholar Isaac West gave a really interesting presentation. I mean, it was really about how cereal, not the cereal that we eat, but the NPR hit success podcast, obviously, I'm not the professional comedian hosting tonight, but the, you know, the breakthrough podcast that cereal was basically introduced podcastery to a whole broader world. And so, like, people who'd never known what a podcast was before knew what they were after Serial. But also that primarily the listeners of a podcast like Serial, the people who consume true crime most, as we've been talking about, are women.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I want to, like, ask you, you know, what does true crime tell us, not only about women and gender, which we've been talking about a little bit, but what does it tell women to watch out for? What is, like, is there any way that we can read true crime as any kind of, like, watch out girl, like, a kind of, like, conduct book or anything? Or does it just, you know, give us, like, a primer on, like, this is just the way the world is. Watch out. Don't get killed. You know, like, I don't know. I mean,
well,
Sarah,
also want to quickly make the connection. You know, we heard Alex Cunningham kind of mention the soap, right? And how the soap is sort of the basis of so many narratives about, like, emotional vulnerability. Mm-hmm. I think that's what also draws a kind of largely female audience to true crime. And she, of course, is making that connection in the Dirty John show, right? But yeah, I mean, absolutely. It women, like, you listen to something like The Teacher's Pet and you hear kind of in these follow-up podcasts, women are very invested in these narratives of what have happened to other women. It's almost a way of kind of, there's a lot of retroactive seeking of justice, you know, and women themselves becoming, as Veronica does in Dirty John, their own sort of private investigators who are like, God damn it, I'm going to save, you know,
I'm going to stick this thing on the car. An Uber drive all the way over there.
Yeah. And because, like, you know, it's like, God damn it, no, not one more. Not one more. And, like, I mean, there's something really, like, beautiful to that. And that feel like, you know, all these women who are, you know, on the case of Lynette Dawson in The Teacher's Pet, and they're just like, they're calling in and they're leaving messages and they're like, I knew someone who went to school, you know, with Chris Dawson, and, like, maybe this is a good lead for you. And they're, like, all going into, like, their holes, tacking things up on the wall, creating,
but,
like,
you know why?
You know why?
Because I think, honestly, Sarah and Karen, Kessler Tongsons, I feel like women have always, Lifetime has dramatized. I say Lifetime because they literally have coined, they've built an entire industry on this.
We have to pay homage.
We have to pay homage, okay? But, you know, you can only see so many of the same tropes so many times where you're like, I get it.
Yes.
People in your small Canadian town murder each other.
Yeah.
And may or may not have been on Just the 10 of Us. I feel like the with Snapped and, you know, being able to sort of start seeing, and even recently with this Chris Watts situation, which I don't know if you guys are familiar about.
Oh, my God, yes.
Which is just horrific.
The Colorado story.
Well, there's this one data point that, because I'm a very big true crime fan, they said about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, forensic science research has shown that serial killers have dwindled because technology works against them, because it's just harder to murder in mass, right? So they become cops. Kidding. Shit. I said it.
Damn.
Cry 2 tears in a bucket. Fuck it. So no, I'm just saying that there is, you know, this need to understand, like, if we're starting to get into this world where I didn't really think in 2018 we'd have another crazy story like this, where this guy thought for real.
He really,
you know,
yeah.
We haven't seen anything of this horrific magnitude since the murder of Lacey Peterson by Scott, her husband. And, you know, that, again, was one of the inspirations for Gone Girl. Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen stuff like this in a while. And this is, I feel like everybody keeps commenting, like, why is this a big deal? I said, because he literally did the most obvious, basic thing.
He murdered his wife and kids for his girlfriend. Yeah.
And if you watch, like, it's absolutely...
We're talking about Chris Watt in Colorado.
If you watch that footage of him, you know, the morning after the disappearance, mm-hmm. where he's still fronting like he didn't do anything, it is utterly chilling, and I think recalls someone like John Meehan, you know, in Dirty John, where he's just like, I don't know, I just want them to come back. I want my family to come back.
Yep.
And you're literally just like, there's nothing behind his eyes. He's like, you know, he's just... He is a man, and he felt that he would be able to get away with stuffing his daughters in these, you know, these containers and burying his wife in a shallow grave at his place of work while planning a vacation with his girlfriend.
Which is insane!
Yeah, the thing is, he thinks he can get away with it because they literally have, as these true crime podcasts have
men
taught
us... Men
have
been getting away with it for so long.
That's the thing about Bear Brook, which many of you listeners have pointed out has been, like, a really compelling listen.
Yes.
Is that, you know, it's this cold case, this, you know, finding these bodies in barrels, like, in New Hampshire.
That have been there... have been there since Lynette Dawson and Teacher's Pet was...
You know, in the 80s again.
Killed. Yeah.
But all of this forensic science has to go into, like, finally figuring out, like, which guy did this and for, you know, like, and, you know, one of them is DNA related. So that was, like, a child of his. You know, like, it's mm-hmm. literally, like, so many of these true crime podcasts in particular have shown us, like, through, like, a kind of long and plodding scientific plot lines often, mm-hmm. or, like, in kind of, like, these threads that go nowhere, because this is always the kind of thing that tends to happen, especially in the investigative reporting podcast, that, you know, despite how obvious it is, as you pointed out, Winter, so many people want to reject that story. Nobody wants to believe that someone could
do that. A handsome guy like Chris Watts with just beautiful family.
And or I also, Chris Dawson or any of these people. Or like, you know, Dirty John.
That's what I'm saying. And this is, goes back to what I was kind of saying is that, maybe I don't know if I said it yet. I've had a little bit of vodka. There is also something to be said about the fact that if you're super attractive, there's absolutely no way that you've done this. Like, how do you have time for being so pretty?
Jeffrey Dahmer, right? Again. I mean, you know, that...
He was ugly to me, though.
But, I mean, but the kind of mythology around him, right, is that I actually haven't looked at a picture of him in probably a really long time.
Look at him now. He looks like a murderer.
He looks like a murderer, but, I mean, well, there was so much...
They say Ted Bundy was cute, and I'm like, he's not that cute.
There was so much else that went into, you know, I mean, the Jeffrey Dahmer thing is a whole episode, obviously, and there was so much that went into the kind of him being able to get away with these serialized killings for so long, including deep racism embedded in the kind of Milwaukee police force.
Yeah.
But you know, one of the ways that he would sort of stalk his victims was to be, you know, a man who would kind of go into like these gay bars.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, attractive enough that he could sort of just get whoever to go home with him and trust him. And yeah, I mean, I don't like to use the word predator very often, but he was like deeply predatory,
Deeply predatory.
Yeah.
And like, you see John Wayne Gacy, and if John Wayne Gacy was coming at me, I'd be like, actually, no, left. Please, you know, go left. I mean, that's the one thing that I think attracted us early on. And that's one thing they would use usually when they were trying to, you know, you see it in Star 80. They talk about how Paul was attractive in a sleazy way, but attractive. But sort of like when he was with Dorothy, it heightened sort of how attractive he was. And then you get somebody like Eric Roberts, who's was hot, very attractive at the time. And the same thing with Mark Harmon playing Ted Bundy. I think is the word mythologized?
I think we do. I think that there is this sense that
because they were portrayed.
Yeah. I mean, and you have Eric Mana now playing Dirty John, mm-hmm. right? And which is one of the things, I think that the sad thing is that in our visual representations of this on TV, in these made-for-TV movies or in these movies or limited series, what have you, they always cast a very handsome, mm-hmm. like, leading man kind of actor in these situations where, you know, and whereas in IRL, in real life, these guys are, like, a squidge or several less handsome, but they still have the same power and they still get away with these same things, the same forms of manipulation, you know. And I mean, I'm wondering, though, to what extent you find the how much podcasts, particularly true crime podcasts, have helped actually change or solve crimes for people. Do you think that, like, there's been an impact now that we've, you know, kind of switched from the format of, like, mythologizing some of these stories on TV or in movies? Like, I mean, do either of you have any opinions on whether or not you think the podcasts themselves have really changed the dynamics or maybe changed some of the outcomes of these cold cases and stories?
Well, I think just like a quick take that I have is that on a sort of individualized basis, yes, absolutely. You look at something like Teacher's Pet and what has occurred since.
Or in the dark, I guess.
Or in the dark. At a structural level.
No one's mentioned Serial.
Serial.
I know, it's true. No, it's true. And Serial has, you know, like, really.
Because I don't care about what happened.
I know. And I mean, and I feel
at that Best Buy. I wasn't there. I didn't see it.
We're sorry, but, you know, everybody. We haven't talked about Serial.
I mean, I think
one
of the things that gets sacrificed in the deep investment in these individual narratives, I think in a way, even though I really don't, I mean, I probably shouldn't be saying this on a podcast. I really don't love the kind of the guy who did the Atlanta Monster series.
Yeah.
You know, and that was also focused on a singular individual, but was, I think, trying to maybe do something slightly different from these kind of individualized nuclear family narratives of, like, a woman who's been killed. But I think that, you know, what happens when we get this really deep investment in individual stories is that, like, in the case of something like Teacher's Pet, it's like justice for Lynn, right? And it becomes justice for what's his face in Making a Murderer, right? And
Mark, I don't know.
Stephen Avery.
Right.
And, you know, and I mean, what ends up happening is kind of like, you know, how will we affect change at, like, at sort of a structural level in the criminal justice system, you know, or how are we going to, you know, change gender relations in such a way that, like,
yeah,
these, you know, that we don't need to have these sorts of stories anymore. And it seems to me that that isn't really.
But I only look at it from a different perspective because I'm obsessed with true crime, and I believe that there are certain people in the world who just commit crime and they're criminals, and I you know, and I want to know,
and they often tend to be men,
and they often tend to be men,
and for some reason
so they're all guys.
But I just think that, like, you know, I'm not going to be quick to say that podcasts have revolutionized anything. This has always been you think of In Cold Blood, like, mm-hmm. there's yes. always been an interest all the way back to the 30s, and some of the yes. first films and the silent movies were all based around a crime, mm-hmm. or the, you know, the history of a crime or some crime. So there, it's less about, like, it's just another opportunity, it's mm-hmm. just another medium in which you can tell a story. I'm more interested in a podcast that focuses entirely like a Serial, even though I haven't listened to it, but I, you know, I'm just not interested in what happened at that Best Buy. I'm more interested in a season long procedural approach, yeah. than I am on hearing, like, this week it's all about Bambi. Like, I want right. to hear actually well thought out researched, you know, and not just hot takes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I know we've been talking a lot about really sensational stories, because that is a lot of what true crime is based on. But, you know, and maybe Serial being the kind of touchstone or litmus test around this, even if we don't want it to be, but, like, it, you know, it is the thing in the podcast world that does that. Do we think now that the next true crime move is to move towards more procedural and everyday crime stories, like the third season of Serial, or like something like In the Dark, which takes on these cases, and or including, you know, things that may have been like kind of less sensational crimes and really works its
like
way through.
Parking tickets?
Not quite parking tickets. You know, just average murders.
That was my entree into crime.
I mean, so much of it, I feel like I'm being so serious tonight, but so much of it has to do with what, you know, when something happens to a person, is that considered sensational or is that just what happens to that person? And that has to do with race, gender. It has to do with all these power structures, right? So, like, I mean, God, I can't believe I'm being this person in the room right now. Like, I feel like I'm being so boring, but I mean, like, you know, it's like, is it so sensational because it happens to, like, a rich, like, OC woman with her... You know, and, like, and I mean, part of it is that, right? Like, where you're like, this person's life is perfect, and then it was shattered.
And, you know,
someone who lives in poverty and is subject to, like, abuse, you know, and ultimately gets murdered, no one gives a shit, right?
There's no true crime podcast about that.
There's no true crime podcast about that.
She's nameless, right?
Well, this is not to go off genre, but this is why I think people love Candyman.
I am the writing on the wall, the whisper in the classroom. Without these things, I am nothing. So now I must shed innocent blood. Come with me.
Candyman is a movie that literally to this day haunts the fuck out of me because it's a predominantly black cast. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It talks about the inner city. It talks about somebody who lurks and haunts, but nobody's actually going there. And this white savior goes and gets her ass snatched and becomes one of them. Right. And I think that, you know, Candyman goes into the halls of being like a legacy horror film because it takes this, it diverts into a space where it's not like a pretty prairie like Night of the Living Dead, or it's not like a suburb like any of the other horror movies where, you know, shit runs amok. And so, you know, look, yes, it's harder to get people interested in those stories where it's predominantly POC or it's predominantly women of color, but I don't think that exists in this world anymore because I think we've seen every single, like, to me, Dirty John, the one thing, I love Dirty John and I think it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think, like, have I already seen this story? Do I already know what's going to happen? Yeah. All you bitches down in Orange County don't get it. Most 9 out of 10 of these dudes are cool. 1 out of 10 of them might be shady.
Sure.
I mean, Vicky Gunvalson on Real Housewives of Orange County stretched 2 seasons with Brooks and his fake cancer having ass.
Oh, my God.
And that's like a...
That's what I was thinking, too, about how easily Dirty John slides into the Real Housewives.
And absolutely. She's so smart and has a business back to Dirty John, but you don't know if he's a nurse or a doctor.
Yeah, right.
You know, like, anesthesia, it's just like, I can't feel sorry for you that much.
Yeah, but it is true. Like, I mean, that no
one
is...
Oh, my God, the anesthesiology scenes, by the way. Like, I feel like those are the kind of where the real, like, horror lies. Mm-hmm. You know, in that... I think they're just in first Dirty episode John. Where it kind of cuts quickly to, like...
Yes.
You know, and this patient, it's like... It seems to be suggesting that he did something terrible to her. She's, like, in extreme pain and, like... I mean, but it's, like, this weird blip where it just occurs in the first episode and then kind of goes away.
It's a red herring that I feel like will come back again.
It'll come back.
And mind you, we're only 2 episodes in. I feel like he's going to eventually knock her out with like an iron.
Something messed up's going to happen.
But as you were saying,
sure.
Like Monster tries to address...
Atlanta Monster tries to address that. And I mean, I think that there are, you know, attempts to address that. But if you look at, you know, again, something like Making a Murderer, which has been, you know, on Netflix, which has been such a kind of like insane success, right? It's really about, you know, there's an interesting conversation happening about class there, for sure.
There are a lot of conversations happening about class.
There's actually a lot happening about class, but it seems like somehow it's not...
It's fewer conversations about race and true crime unless you've got OJ, you know?
Unless you've got OJ. But mm-hmm.
Or celebrity-oriented or something like that. And I think that that's where... You know, again, like with the exception of like...
I think it's creepier, though, if they aren't rich. Like, I think it's creepier. It's not surprising to me that money makes people crazy and do crazy things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have historical references for that all the way back until the fall of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I think it's more interesting nowadays to see. I don't really care about these rich white people continuing to make mistakes. I'm more interested in... hearing, like, there are stories with, you know, people of color and women of color and whomever who've had to make sacrifices and these stories don't get told. I want to see more of that.
This is where, and I will want to close with this as a recommendation for those of you who haven't listened to it yet, the Sports Illustrated podcast called Fall of a Titan around former quarterback Steve McNair's death, right? And dying alongside his mistress, and that there are a lot more kind of complex class and racial dynamics that are happening in that storyline. Sure, he's an NFL athlete, like, and it is about like wealth and like prurience in these different ways, but it also like delves into some of these relationships in different communities that I think affect how seriously or how easily we judge the kind of outcome of who committed what crime,
right?
How it went down and that kind of thing. So
you mean the black guy did it?
Well, it supposedly his mistress did it, and she was a Persian woman of color, right? Supposedly, but looking deeper into the crime suggests that some other things may have gone down.
Sure.
In any case, obviously, the world of true crime podcasts, broadcasting, books, movies, etc., is so huge that we couldn't possibly touch upon everything that all of you who so generously responded to us wanted us to talk about. But in any case, you know, give us a call. Talk to us about what you want to talk about. You've been listening to Pop Rocket. We're not going to be committing any crimes on this break, but we'll get back to you soon.
Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hello, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is Wonderful.
It's a podcast that we do as we are married. And how's the ad going so far? Because I think it's going very good.
We talk about things we like every week on Wednesdays.
One time Rachel talked about pumpernickel bread. It was so tight. You cannot afford to miss her talking about this sweet brown bread.
We also talk about music and poems and, you know, weather.
There was one... weather? One time Rachel talked about Baby Beluga, this song, for like 14 minutes. And it just really blew my hair back.
So check us out on MaximumFun.org.
It's a cool podcast with chill vibes. Amber is the color of our energy, is what all the iTunes reviews say.
They will now.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio,
Winter Mitchell-Rorbaugh.
Sarah Kessler.
Every week on Pop Rocket, you know we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Sarah Kessler, I get to ask you, what is your current jam this week?
Okay, well, this is sort of a weird choice, but I heard Stereolab playing in a coffee shop in Silver Lake.
Shocking!
A few months back.
I was in a hipster coffee shop.
But it like seemed very outdated to me. And then I was like, oh, maybe like I'm finally cool again. And so I like for the first time in many, many years listened to Mars Audiac Quintet, which is their 1994 album.
Yeah.
And which like I basically had like on loop on my Sony boombox in my bedroom for like between 94 and 96 or 97, maybe probably till 97, honestly, right, if I'm honest. I really loved Letitia Sadier's like sophisticated French accent and occasional French lyrics. But this song is sung in English. My song for the week is sung in English, and it's a kind of like gradually building instrumental rock out until 2.5 minutes in, and she starts singing this very depressing poem that feels really relevant right now. And I can read you the whole poem because it's very short. It's like she just says, and she repeats it several times, "In whatever society, there invariably will seem to be just a few men keen to rule. Overwhelming, the majority will assent and allow them to do so."
Wow.
And it's just like, hope not. You know, it's like now. Yeah.
And what's the song?
It's called Outer Accelerator.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is, like, in her voice, it just sounds so pleasant and not sinister, but
it's kind of like
that's how everything
Belle
sounded.
Bell and Sebastian.
It's true.
Yeah.
That is how everything sounded then.
Yeah.
Winter, what have you got for us this week?
I'm figuring out, like, what I'm going to start for 2019 as, like, a thing, because I need to bring back the quadrants around.
Yes.
And this song, I have heard my entire life, and I didn't understand the importance of the song passed down from my mom until I really came into my womanhood. I'm on a Grace Jones kick in a really, really aggressive way.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Slave to the Rhythm is a song that I used to make fun of because people used to just make fun of it because back when everybody was like super stupid and didn't understand androgyny and being transphobic and, you know, sexualizing Grace Jones and also, you know, making her feel like she was too masculine to be sexy or whatever, you know, that really dumb period in the early 90s, you know, in the late 80s where people didn't understand like how fucking magnanimous she is. And was mocked like heavily on In Living Color. You kind of go along with that because Jim Carrey ruled the world in that era. Whoa. But now I've listened to so many. So I play this song every single fucking day because it is a sweeping epic of a fucking song. And this woman does not get enough credit from transcending disco, which was a blip in the radar for her. And she could have walked out. She could have been washed away with that. And she ended up making some really, really amazing music post disco.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And Slave to the Rhythm is that.
This is it.
This is a quadrant. Don't try to cut me off, KT.
I'm not cutting you off, baby. I'm not cutting you off.
No, this is Slave to the Rhythm is every single fucking quadrant times 10. And that's what I'm going to do for 2019. I'm only going to pick songs once a month. That's every single fucking quadrant times infinity. And this is that song.
10 quadrants.
Yes. 10 quadrants.
To the river, to the river.
Fucking Grace Jones. I mean, did you see any of her Hollywood Bowl shows?
No, and I'm not gonna miss anything else that ever comes up. So can we be on Grace Jones Watch as a collective?
Yes, we are on Grace Jones Watch as a collective.
I feel this like we were the only lesbians who didn't see Grace Jones at the Hollywood Bowl.
I saw Grace Jones not that time around, but the one prior. Mm. I'm sorry. Yeah, it was the Blood Red
lesbian.
Moon. I know.
All of our friends were like,
"Your
not
lesbian
going to
newsletter
Grace
didn't let you
yeah.
know."
Well, this is
so messed up.
But please, everyone, listen to everything Grace Jones
ever
recorded.
Even watch A View to a Kill. I don't care how much you hate that Bond movie. Watch it.
Again, it is 10,000 quadrants.
Yes.
And so my song happens to be a throwback at once to the 90s and to the 70s because it is Juliana Hatfield. Remember her from the 90s with the Lemonheads. And, you know, she had a great song on the Reality Bites soundtrack called Spin the Bottle. Yeah. But, you know, she just this year in 2018 recorded a whole album of Olivia Newton-John covers. And, you know, she did this because she wanted to support, actually, the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Wellness and Research Center, Olivia's own cancer treatment organization. And as she said about ONJ, she said, "Listening to her is an escape into a beautiful place. She's inspired me so much personally, and I just want to give something back to share some of these tremendous songs reinterpreted with love by me." And so here is Juliana Hatfield singing for you, Olivia Newton-John's A Little More Love. Such a pleasurable album to listen to. And if you buy the record, all of these proceeds, again, will go to the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Wellness and Research Center. All right, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Karen Tongson, with Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh, a.k.a. Ragnarok, and Sarah Kessler. Sarah, where can people find you online?
At Movable Jaw, as in the jaw of a ventriloquist dummy. Or just someone's jaw moving.
On Twitter, right?
Yes, on Twitter, yes. You can't follow me on Instagram, it's private.
All right. Our theme music, as always, is Party Booby Trap by Uzzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. This week, we don't have any 5-star reviews to share. It's no wonder that Magwops could not make it here tonight last minute because of some stomach flu issues. It's actually not Magwops who suffered the stomach flu, but Dear Silas. So, you know, you're like jeopardizing a whole family out there if you do not review us on iTunes. You gotta take care of the whole Wappler Earl clan.
Or they won't be here next week, and we are going to literally scare.
We got them coming next week.
Yeah.
You know? So definitely send us your 5-star reviews because, you know, slated for next week, Margaret is actually going to be in her hosting part of the rotation in the coven. And guess who one of our special guests will be? It's going to be David Earle, Madame Wappler's beloved father of Silas. So if you want to see that happen, you've got to put those 5-star reviews up there. Or else who knows what's going to happen. The family's going to have scones. They're going to have to be in a bubble. You know, come on, folks. Do it for us. If you have feedback that you want to give us, or if you want to ask us for advice, you haven't asked us for advice yet. You just want to talk to us about all sorts of random shit. You can call 530-237-4108. That's 530-237-4108. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket. Come to our Instagram, at Pop Rocket Podcast, or join our Facebook group and be a part of the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org. The show is edited by Shana Deloria, and our senior producer, as always, who went to the bathroom twice tonight during recording, is Laura Swisher.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.